Last Sunday, I offered a very brief recounting after we had shared the waters from our various journeys. I offered a very brief recounting of my summer travels, and I built it around the theme of the rivers that I either passed by or crossed over before coming back and rejoining with all of you here on the banks of our own Nashua River. In those remarks, I made a very passing reference of a trip I took to Texas following the Unitarian Universalist General Assembly in St. Louis. I went down there to visit with some family that I have in that area. So I want to go back to that part, my remarks for my openers today, and tell you about a stop-off that I made for a few hours en route to my sister and brother-in-law's home. After flying down from St. Louis to Dallas, I got me a car and drove south towards Waco and then turned west to the town of Crawford. Now, Crawford it's more like a hamlet, really. It's a very small Texas town, and it's an amazingly hot place, even in late June. Quite a few miles, actually, outside of Crawford, as many of you know, is the ranch where President Bush maintains his Texas residence and where he usually spends a few weeks every summer. I can tell you there's not much to see of the ranch from this little country road that goes past it, other than the seemingly endless open space that is typical of that part of the country, as well as a few cows that are out there wandering around. But I didn't go to Crawford to look at the ranch anyway, be it the president's or anyone else's. I went there to pay a short visit to a very modest little establishment called the Crawford Peace House. Now, before I learned a little more about this place by going to its website, I had mistakenly thought that it had been established in conjunction with the peace vigil that Cindy Sheehan held near the Bush Ranch back in the summer of 2005. I believe she went back this previous summer. But I was wrong. That's been known to happen. although Miss Sheehan did spend some time there on her way to what she called Camp Casey in the summer of 2005, this building called the Peace House was actually purchased clear back in the spring of 2003 when our invasion of Iraq was imminent. At that time, some peace activist folks in Austin got enough money together for a down payment on this little nondescript house on a nondescript street in a nondescript Texas town. Nondescript except for the fact that the President of the United States had his own not-so-nondescript place several miles out of town. Those who purchased the house and continued to raise the funds needed to fix it up and keep up the payments on it and all the rest of that felt that it was important to maintain what they called a moral witness in the face of the Iraqi war and the powers that be who initiated it. Well, now, this moral witness clearly has a political angle to it, which is not what I'm going to develop this morning. For those who would like to have a little more conversation with me about this trip, I'm going to be in the fellowship room at 7 o'clock this evening, complete with my little slideshow, you know, what I did on my trip, slideshow, some of the pictures I took there. And I'd like to follow that up with what I hope will be a very open conversation about what it means and how to best be an advocate for peace in these times, particularly after some of the events of the past summer. I'm going to save all that for this evening. Just have a few things I want to add about this visit for now. I emailed ahead to the people who staffed this house on a very limited basis, telling them when I had planned to arrive, but the way my trip went, I got there earlier than I had planned. There was nobody around. So I just sat on the porch of this place for a while and kind of watched Light and Crawford go by. And then I braved the heat long enough to go over to a side yard where they built a labyrinth. Maybe some of you walk these labyrinths, you're in a circle, you kind of go back and forth and double back and forth with a peace pole right in the middle of it. I think the idea being to show you how circuitous and difficult and setbacks and all the rest of that, the path to peace can indeed be. I did manage to, make that walk. Eventually, a couple of women did arrive. They let me in. They showed me around, told me about some of the activities that are held there from time to time, rallies, concerts, programs, and the like. And the thing that really struck me is you could walk through the whole house in just a couple of minutes, but the thing that really struck me about it was the number of religious and spiritually oriented symbols and sayings and all the rest of that that are both on the ground and inside this little building, it had something of the flavor of a small religious retreat center, while, as I just said, it also has a decidedly political tone to it. But the thing that really stayed with me the most as I finally wrapped up my visit and said goodbye to the people who had hosted me there, headed off into a Texas sunset, as it were. I discovered sunsets in Texas take a long time. There's nothing to get in the way of the sun as it goes down. The overall image I was left with, though, as I kind of drove out of town and headed on my way, more so than any one thing I had specifically seen or heard, was just this image of this little building, this very small outpost, as it were, just sitting there and making its statement and maintaining its presence, while a few miles away from what is, at least at times, the center or the focus of the greatest assemblage of power and might in the world. And putting aside, if we can, all the accompanying political issues that go with that, if we can put that on the back burner for just a minute, I also decided that this little house served as a pretty good metaphor for the place and standing of liberal religion in the larger society and culture that we inhabit at this present time. Now, this is not exactly late-breaking news, but we are in the midst, and have been for some time, of a very conservative and evangelical religious surge or revival in this country. Like I say, that's not exactly new news. And I don't decry that altogether, incidentally. I found that I have some common ground on certain issues and causes with evangelical Christians, attempting to alleviate hunger being one of them. This past Thursday, for example, we here hosted a dinner in our dining room, and Dan already spoke to this, for the recruiters for the upcoming crop walk in our community to help alleviate, even in some small way, world hunger. And I'd say some of our local faith communities representing a very wide spectrum in this community were here, and I'm happy to make common cause with them on an issue where we do have some of the same sentiments and the same dedication. And I would join with Dan in urging as many of you to participate in this effort, either by being a crop walker yourself or sponsoring someone from our congregation who does. And I knew that when I took on the presidency, as I still have, from this National Area Interfaith Council, which is the sponsoring organization for this walk, I knew it would mean working on certain projects with people whose opinion I did not share on various kinds of religious and social issues, but with whom I could find common ground on others. In fact, when I agreed to take on this office, my primary question was not, can I work with a wide range of religious opinion and belief, but rather, do they all want me? Which I guess they did. But back to where I began, I still find a number of aspects of this right-wing religious surge quite troubling. And I'm going to speak to that in more detail next week. My sermon title for next Sunday is, Are We a Theocracy? The short answer is no, we're not, but we do tend to behave like one. That's the 10-second answer. If you want the 20-minute version, you've got to come back a week from today. So, to get back on track, given the larger religious climate in this country right now, I got this image or metaphor as I left Crawford of Unitarian Universalism in a small house by the road, sitting there in the face of faster, greater, and ostensibly more powerful forms and expressions of religion as an interaction with the culture that we're a part of right now. I confess to being a little uneasy with such a metaphor, even as I use it, for I do not mean to imply by it that we are powerless or insignificant. I don't believe we are on either count. What I mean to say instead is that there is a certain power to be had in simply maintaining a presence and in keeping faith with the values or the principles one holds and shares with like-minded folk, however at variance they may be or seem to be with the surrounding climate. This This is the kind of power that a physically short of stature, very large in other ways, physically short of stature woman, like Rosa Parks demonstrated and unleashed, when she just sat down in the front of a bus in Birmingham, Alabama, 1955. It's the kind of power Nelson Mandela exhibited during those 27 years that he sat in a jail cell in South Africa's Robben Island. It's the kind of power the ordinary and unarmed citizens of East Berlin demonstrated as they stood at the Berlin Wall before it literally collapsed. In each of these cases, the power and the presence of an idea and those who were willing to stand for it prevailed in the face of seemingly impenetrable odds. So I speak then of the power of presence, the power of simply showing up, the power of being, the power of ideas and ideals. This is the kind of power Mahatma Gandhi spoke of when he told his followers, "All that you do may seem insignificant, but it's very important that you do it anyway." Well, I'm not going to predict that we here are going to be the instigators of such momentous happenings as the ones I've just referred to, but I think it's important to have that in mind as we maintain our presence here. And I would like to turn our attention now to some of the things that I think it means for us in this place to maintain the presence of an idea and of a liberal religious Unitarian Universalist community and congregation in this wider community of Nashville and in the even larger community that extends beyond it to ultimately encompass the world in which we live, move, and interact. For I do believe that our very presence can and will carry a power of its own if we keep faith and uphold it. And in this upcoming church year that is now before us, I would like to think of our maintaining that presence as our shared ministry. Our shared ministry. For in our free church and liberal Protestant tradition, ministry is far more than what an ordained member of the clergy does for his or her congregation. To be sure, as your called minister of over 18 years now, I have my designated responsibilities, which I take very seriously, and to which I recommit myself as each church year gets underway. But ministry, in its best and deepest sense, is what happens in the interplay between the minister and the congregation, as well as in the interplay, or in the dance, to use some of Rick Masten's language, between and among the members themselves. Ministry is what we do together, for ourselves, for the growth and well-being of our congregation, and for the greater human community beyond our walls. And so for us to come together on the onset of another church year is to truly be, as I put it in my sermon title for today, recalled to ministry. Let me run with that for a few minutes. Here at our own house by the road, we are called, first of all, to our ministry with one another. One of the questions I'm occasionally asked when I speak to inquirers about, or challengers to, Unitarian Universalism is, well, if you believe that each individual has to seek meaning and truth for themselves, then what's the point of even having a religious community where certain beliefs are held in common? My answer to that is a line from an old Shoe comic strip, which I know I've used before, where one of the characters says, "I've been thinking about it for some time, and I've decided it's hard to be an individual all by yourself." Or as the novelist and essayist Kurt Vonnegut once put it, "One human being is no human being." We are recalled then to this place, to this house and home, to be in ministry with one another on our journeys of the Spirit and in our searches for greater levels of depth and truth and meaning in our lives, in our pursuit of the holy, the sacred, the transcendent, however we wish and choose to name it, in each of our lives. And yes, you can do that on your own. And indeed, there are times, I know this is true with me, I'm sure it is with you on occasion, where the only person we need or want to be with is our singular self. I think we need to make space in our lives for those kinds of times. But I'm also convinced that the spiritual path, the journey of discovery and meaning, takes on more depth. And is also just plain more fun when it's a shared. You've heard about this already in our service. This fall, beginning this Thursday, we put a series of programs in place, thanks in large measure to the work of Barbara Rios, called Food for Thought Thursdays. This will be an opportunity for all who come in to first share a meal in our dining room and then move into smaller groups that will be focused on a variety of topics where you can share and interact with one another. More information about that in the coffee hour. I hope as many of you as can will join us on this Thursday. Also this week, I'll be meeting with the leaders of our Covenant Group program to take stock of who we have taken part in it and how we can bring in more people. These are groups that meet monthly to share personal joys and concerns as we do in our service, but in a more intimate setting, and then also exchange and share thoughts and ideas about a designated topic that the leader will introduce. If you'd like to be a part of this program, we can make a place for you to sign up for that at our information table or our newcomers table as well. Part of our ministry is our ministry with one another. Another part of it is this ministry with one another is to care for one another as we attend the times in our lives that call for celebration, as well as when we need the comfort and compassion of one another in times of losses and sorrow. We've heard both of those this morning already. Our ministry then is about how we take care of each other. And I have felt, I can say, tremendously blessed over my years with you as I've witnessed the many ways in which our members and friends reach out to one another. When the need for loving hands and loving hearts comes upon us, as it so often does. Still another thing that calls us back to our house by the road are the deep yearnings that come from our hearts and minds and souls and spirits. We come here needing to be connected to one another and connected to that larger reality, that greater spirit of life of which we sing every Sunday that emboldens and blesses us all. We come back to our house seeking a safe and trustworthy place where lives can be freely shared, where fears can be faced and examined, where our souls are fed and nurtured, where our lives and both their wholeness and their brokenness are affirmed. And we also look at this house and home to be a supportive and inspiring standpoint from which we may address our concerns and hopes for our larger world. We look to it to be a supportive standpoint from which we may be advocates for peace and justice, for a safe and saner world. Such a standpoint does not require unanimity of opinion as to how these ends may be accomplished, but it does call for a common commitment to work towards their fruition in this ministry we share. Looking ahead a bit in this regard, on the 15th of October, I think that's four Sundays from today, I'll be sharing this service with some members of our Social Justice Committee. And together we'll be looking at some of the more specific ways we hope we as a congregation can continue to advance our second Unitarian Universalist principle of promoting justice, equity, and compassion in human relations. Keep that Sunday in mind, October 15th. I have just one more thought for today on this overall theme of maintaining a presence. I go back. It was on this Sunday 5 years ago we gathered in this house of worship, as did our fellow citizens in houses of worship across this land, in the aftershocks of the attack of the previous September 11th. The events of that terrifying day had been recalled in a number of ways this past week. I don't generally make a practice, I'm trying to make a practice of quoting myself, but I want to recall just a few of the words I spoke from this pulpit on that Sunday, September 16th, 2001. We know that grief, shock, pain, and bewilderment, especially in the face of horrific loss, in time give way to anger. It would be almost inhuman not to feel anger after such a devastating attack of terrorism. But where do we go with it? This is the challenge before us. It is a challenge unique to any other we as a nation have ever had to face. As we weep for our dead and for those emotionally scarred by death, as we begin to clear the rubble, as we confront our newly felt sense of vulnerability, where do we go with our anger? Close quote. We've now had 5 years to answer that question. Where do we go with our anger? In 5 years, to face the challenge of how we handle what I caught on that day, our newly felt sense of vulnerability. And I have to say, from where I stand and from what I observe, that's all I can speak to at this moment. I'm afraid much of our response, as a nation and from our leaders, has been far more troubling, and to me personally saddening, than it has been hopeful or ennobling. In saying that, I take nothing away from the tremendous acts of courage and self-sacrifice that were exhibited 5 years ago this week, acts and efforts that are still very rightfully recalled, rightfully honored, rightfully celebrated. But we also turned our anger, our cynically manipulated anger, I would maintain, on a country that, while despotically ruled, to be sure, had done us no harm. And as a result of which, we find ourselves in a terrible morass halfway around the world and terribly sad, divided here in our part of the world. And that newly felt sense of vulnerability, which was and is as very real as our lives, has also, I would again maintain, been cynically manipulated, placing us in a climate of fear and mistrust we have rarely known and experienced in our history as a nation. And I remain convinced we can and must take the prudent measures that are required to give us the acceptable degree of security that any nation needs to conduct its civic life. I'm convinced we can do that without having to fear fear itself. These are subjects for more conversation on other days. For in these days, I continue strive to be a person of faith. Faith in the power of hope and trust over fear. And faith in that long arc of the universe which Martin Luther King spoke of as bending towards justice. Most of all, I continue to believe in the power of presence, the idea and the theme with which I began these remarks. And so as we move into this, another year in our life, the 180th year in the history of this congregation, this church, I ask you to join with me, sharing in this liberal religious ministry and being a vital presence, a presence for one another, and a presence for the values and principles we hold dear. So let us open our eyes and our ears and our hearts to one another, and open them to the peoples of this earth, which is our home, as we continue on our road. Our closing hymn is number 112. Do you hear?